Are you ready for a long-term committed relationship? Do you dream of curling up next to someone who is warm and loving? If you answer yes to all of these, you may be ready to open your heart and your home to one of the millions of dogs and cats who are waiting in shelters for a permanent home. By adopting your four-legged friend rather than buying one from a breeder or a pet store, you'll help save a life and find true love. For more information, please visit helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
And it is exactly 6 o'clock on a Tuesday night time, once again, on WUSB Stony Brook 4, Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, indeed, I'm here.
Well, it's raining. It's mid-January. It's raining outside. It was on the Fahrenheit scale in the 70s a couple days ago.
It got a little cooler in the last couple days.
It did get a little cooler, but it's still raining. I'm not happy. I'm happy about this. Upcoming forecast, I noticed, is still in Celsius on our computer. I switched it a few weeks ago, and I think nobody knows how to switch it back. So, yeah, on Thursday and Friday, it'll be -7 Celsius at night. So, okay, that's good. But will there be snow? Probably not. You know, as part of the conspiracy that's going on, it gets cold, gets dry, gets warmer, and it gets wet. So you get rain, you get no snow. It's starting to really bug me, so... Something has to be done. Something has to be done. We have a lot to talk about tonight, but you know what we're going to do? We're going to fade down the theme a little early and start this up. Yes, it's our feature, Films of the Year That Was, where we journey back into time and look at Academy Award-winning pictures all the way from the beginning until now. But it'll take us quite a while to get to now. We're at 1965, the second half of 1965. You know, that theme, when that theme starts up with the film projector, reminds me of The Man in the High Castle. You know, the film about what happens if the Nazis won?
Oh, right. The projection over a statue of Eagle.
Because it's about all these films that somehow exist in an alternate universe that are making their way into this universe, or the universe where the Nazis won. So people say, hey, maybe the Nazis didn't win. Maybe there's another universe. It's kind of weird, but it starts with the film projector. And then they play the song Edelweiss.
Weiss?
That famous German-Austrian anthem that was known throughout the that time. No, turns out it wasn't. Turns out that song was written by Rodgers and Hammerstein in the 1950s. And nobody in Austria knows that song, which is kind of funny. We learned that, actually, after watching the film last week, The Sound of Music from 1965, because that's what the song was written for.
Yeah, we sort of have projected it culturally onto Austria, even though, I mean, I guess because there's a foreign word in the title.
It's such a perfect song, though. They should have had that song already, you know? My Homeland Forever, that's how it ends. It's just lost opportunity there.
I do like that sequence in the beginning of the show you were talking about, where they're projecting the image of the Third Reich's bird, or imperial bird, whatever, from their crest or seal or whatever.
A blue jay, is it what it is? No, I don't know what it is.
Right, but they project it onto a statue of sort of an American bald eagle. So you're sort of looking at this alternate dimension or alternate future of projecting a certain history onto an artifact of another, you know, so that it becomes this new artifact of a combination. Anyway,
I gotta say,
the hair on the back of my neck goes up when I hear that intro.
It is a really good intro, and I would even dare to say that the intro is better than the show. Because, boy, that show's gotten muddy and confused, and I don't even know who's good and who's bad and what universe they're in. But there's basically a move to have less intros on TV shows. Have you noticed this? A lot of shows just give you the title, and then the action begins. And I think the intro, I mean, how could you have All in the Family without the song every week? How can you have Sanford and Son without watching, you know, the pickup truck?
Or Portlandia.
Yeah, all those. I don't know Portlandia, but there are so many good intros.
But you know the intro.
It sets the tone. It sets the tone, and it's important to do that. And I think we skip so much, and we miss so much.
Well, and the services now are creating buttons and,
oh my
and ways
God.
To...
Oh, my God, Netflix. It's so annoying. You know, first of all, you go to Netflix to watch something, and you're bombarded with previews that start talking to you immediately, and they start auto-playing an episode that you're not ready for yet. You haven't gotten your refreshments organized, and it's starting to play, and you have to hit stop, and then it's all out of sequence. It's horrible.
Okay, we're going off.
And then there's a little button that says skip intro, which is invasive. I don't want to skip intro. Can you please remove the button that says skip intro? It's annoying me. And then at the end of the episode, oh, my God. God, you can't see the end credits. You have to go through all this button pushing to get the credits to come back on because they're all ready to play the next episode, assuming you want to watch TV for the rest of your life. And by the time you've gotten the credits back, you've missed like 5 seconds of them. I like to read credits, all right? You know, a lot of people work on these things. They should get the credit they deserve. Why aren't there riots in the street about this? I ask this about everything. But
I can't read fast enough for some of the credits. You're a lot better at taking in all of the information they rush through.
Well, often. That's when they're on the screen in the first place. But mm-hmm. but they make this little tiny thing in the corner, and that's the default. Look, Netflix, you can do that if you want, but at least have an option for people who don't want that and make that their default option so they don't have to go nuts every time an episode ends. You know, you end something on a dramatic note, right? You want it to sink in. You don't want all of a sudden to have a promo for another show 1 second after the main character's been killed off or something. Don't you know anything about films or TV shows or drama or art? I'm sorry.
Could you?
I'll sit down. No,
I think you're going to have to play that once more.
The theme?
Yeah, just...
Did I ruin it?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I get very impassioned about these things. Here we go. But doesn't that remind you of Man in High Castle?
All right.
Time they turn on the projector.
Focus on 1966.
No, we're still in 1965. We only did one film from 1965. Okay. Remember, we're doing domestic and foreign.
All right, I'll let you catch up.
We did domestic, Sound of Music, talked about that last week.
I can't get it out of my head.
What, the songs?
It's just all the songs. Yeah, I've been just...
So many songs.
Yeah, What Do You Do With a Girl Like Maria? Yeah, just...
Which is interesting because it followed West Side Story, where there was also a girl named Maria that there was a song about.
Yeah, it seemed like they recycled that a little bit.
And here's an interesting story, too. Not to dwell on the film we already talked about, but Julie Andrews, who was the star of Sound of Music, was also the star of Mary Poppins, a film we didn't see because it didn't win the award. But that came out the year before. But it had not come out while they were filming Sound of Music. So she was singing this song to the children when they weren't filming, called Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, or however you pronounce it, and the kids thought she just made that up on the spot for them because the film hadn't come out yet. Talk about dumb kids. I'm sorry, they're still alive. I don't mean that. But the story Mary Poppins about a woman who basically gets kids to... I guess see the potential in themselves and enjoy life. The King of Siam, basically the same thing, and Sound of Music. You know, it's basically the same story, always being told over and over again with music.
Yeah, coming in, fixing the family, becoming a love interest, the variations on it are a bit nauseating. I think the musical genre too is, in and of itself, worth a study. I respect it. I'm not a huge fan of it cinematically because I think it, on a certain level, detracts from the storytelling. I know in some circles that would be sacrilege to say, and like everything about every movie ever is based on the important work that was done then. I think noir and other genres of film have equal footing there, but that you could debate. I'm not too keen on it. It's not film in the same way as like a proper movie.
Well, doesn't it sort of also detract from lack of a story? So if you have a poor story and you suddenly belt out a hit number,
well, that's true.
People kind of forget that, hey, the film sucks, you know? But I think it would be interesting, though, if other films were musicals that you didn't expect to be musicals, like, say, On the Waterfront, all of a sudden, you know, I could have been somebody that actually is a catchy tune. You know, or The Godfather, you know?
If they slip it in and you
Fredo
don't even...
was like a good singer.
Okay, okay.
Think about that, the potential there.
I'm all for it. I'd like to see it slipped in and, you know, it's like a classic movie, but it's hard to tell. You can't tell that it's like a sleeper musical.
Right.
It's like subtle undertones.
But what about art imitates life? What if life was really like that, where you're walking along and talking to somebody and all of a sudden you start singing to them, you know, and there's this whole big number... What kind of world would that be? There must be planets where this happens. There must be worlds where they live a musical life. But what I always wonder when I'm watching these tunes being belted out on these musicals, you're supposed to believe it's real life, you know, they act like humans, and you're singing the song. What happens if the phone rings, you know, in the middle of that? You have to stop your song, say, you know, no, I'm busy right now.
Or somebody belches.
And all kinds of things could happen, you know. An alarm can go off, or somebody can knock on the door. Yeah, you're just assuming when you start singing that nothing's going to happen to interrupt you for all that time. And it's really kind of hard to believe that life works that way. I have more of a problem with that than the actual song.
Well, don't forget, life works all kinds of ways.
It does. It does. All right, so now we're going to the second part of 1965, which is the shop on Main Street.
Oh, this is fantastic. This is interesting.
It really was. It was actually a Slovak film. It was credited to Czechoslovakia, but that's because the two countries were in a merger at that point. But it's Slovakian. That's the language they're speaking. And it's about it's yet another study of the Nazi era, but really in a fascinating way, because this takes place in a different country where the Germans are occupying, and basically they have something known as the Aryanization program. Get familiar with this, kids, because it's probably coming back, and that's where you basically take over the shops of Jewish people, because they're not allowed to own shops anymore. They're not allowed to even be citizens anymore. And so you have this guy who is assigned by his brother-in-law, who has connections apparently. He's assigned to take over this, what kind of shop was it? A sewing shop? Or
yeah,
something?
She sold buttons.
She sold buttons. You can do that?
Buttons.
A whole shop for
sewing
buttons. Wow.
Yeah, it's like a craft or a textile where you get bolts of cloth or whatever. But yeah, that. Somehow.
Where would I go to do that now? Is there like a...
There's chains and there's small stores. Most of it's online, though, I'd say.
I want to go to the store where I walk in and it's nothing but buttons.
Yeah, there's places like that.
Okay, that's what I want to say. Because this place was crowded with people and they were very passionate about the buttons they wanted. Anyway, so this guy, he's a carpenter. His name is Anton, or Tony, as they call him in the subtitles. He's given a chance to take over the store of this near-death Jewish woman, basically he's trying to explain to her what he's doing there. She doesn't understand because she's really old and she's also deaf, and she thinks he's there to help her or maybe is related to her or something like that. So he strikes up this kind of cordial relationship with her where he comes in and helps out. But then things start to change because they start rounding up the Jews and deporting them. And he's trying to protect her from this. He's trying to keep her in the back, but she's not understanding or listening. She keeps coming forward. He keeps getting more and more angry with her for doing this. And it's really a study in emotion and how people can change the perspective they're coming from. Yeah, he was sympathetic. He was supposed to take over the store, but he decided to have her around and treat her nicely. But then things start to hit the fan, and he starts to get more anxious about himself. And it's aged well, I think.
I think it's
a fascinating study.
It also points out how you respond when communication breaks down. You feel like you have an understanding of the world. The world is changing suddenly or perhaps even slowly, but it changes in ways that you maybe hadn't anticipated, or the challenges you encounter thereafter are things you hadn't anticipated. And so he's thrust into this position where he thought he had an understanding of how he could help or how he could be good in this situation. And then trying to communicate with this woman, it just further breaks down because he's in this position of maintaining as a liaison or like a buffer and can't, because he can't impart to her what's going on as far as people being rounded up. And until she does understand, at which point it's so awful and emotionally shocking that she can't, she doesn't have time to deal with it. She doesn't have a social network because everyone's rounded up in front of her store. I mean, essentially in the town square. The contingencies are the options are fewer. And that being pushed to that point, both characters, both the store owner, it says one thing, yes, as the world changes around you. But also, I think the person tasked with, you know, navigating it or being responsible in some way for her, it shows how difficult and how you can't anticipate what you might face in the future, or that if you don't, the consequences could be grave. And he really struggles. I mean, he's drinking and he is upset. He has really no idea what the world is. Is he a collaborator? Is he a resistor of some sort? Where is he on this spectrum? Should he just give up and turn her in and start a new chapter in his life and forget trying to balance or figure out anything? It really is this dilemma, and I like that, and it's very uncomfortable. It becomes uncomfortable
it
for the viewer.
You see that struggle basically playing out kind of throughout the entire film, but then in rapid succession at the end when things are really happening quickly. I'll say this, it doesn't end well for anybody, really. It's a European film. I'm surprised that something like this, that points the finger at collaborators in the country, something like that came out in Czechoslovakia in 1965. When you think about it, though, Czechoslovakia was always more one of the more Western of the Iron Curtain countries, and they had the Prague Uprising only 3 years later. So there was a lot of interesting cinematic work coming out at that time, and it's fascinating to see this. But I do recommend it. The Shop on Main Street, it's not going to be your typical Hollywood film, I'll tell you that. Be prepared to see some bleakness and to ask yourself some questions. What would you do in that kind of a situation? You see this guy going through all kinds of transformations, going from somebody who believes in protecting people to somebody who's looking out for himself to somebody... Well, remember that time he slapped his wife across the face? I am not in favor of slapping wives across the face, but boy, was she a nasty person. You know, just wanting him to take all of her gold or jewelry or whatever she had earned for her entire life and just constantly haranguing him to look out for them on top of everybody else. And, wow, that was he reacted the right way, I think, to that. But, boy... people change. People change over situations.
It's also interesting from a production perspective. The insignia of the Third Reich was not included, but they had a stand-in for it.
Well, wasn't it included towards the end?
Well,
there was a swastika at the end. There was some other symbol in the middle of the film. Maybe
exactly.
That was the local version of it.
They're
something.
Building a monument. And I think one part of that is the sensitivity of the era, that you're using that imagery, maybe for a big American production, is one thing with Sound of Music, but in this case, this film, it made it a little bit more dystopian and removed, but it's clearly a representation of the Nazis in both how they treat people, rounding them up, and so on and so forth. But I just want to point that out, that I think that was an interesting choice, that they didn't have to say it was them, but they had a similar like armband and insignia of the same symbol. But it is not the same, and it's black and white, of course, so you're not seeing color and that sort of thing. But it's very clearly sort of a fascist tint, or a very, very much a calling on what had been occurring in the previous decade or two.
I think it was pretty directly a Nazi story.
But they were not using those symbols in that.
There could be all kinds of reasons for that. I doubt copyright infringement is one of them. But it could be sensitivity.
That's what I'm saying. I think they were very sensitive, and they wanted to evoke this. They wanted to make the association with the viewer, but they would not become a cult symbol by using that. And I think it was intentional for those reasons.
Yeah, I mean, in Germany, they don't display swastikas in dramatic presentations of that era.
In both regional geographic proximity, but also time.
Remember,
I think
important. We saw in Hamburg, we saw the train miniatures. And for some reason, there was a Nazi rally or something. There was a depiction of World War II, and the symbol was something else. It was just like a square or something crazy like that.
Yep.
Anyway, let's move on to 1966. The domestic film that won the Academy Award was A Man for All Seasons. Actually, it was a British film. There was kind of a partnership between England and the U.S. at this time, where there were a lot of British films that were coming out that were considered distributed in the United States the same as a domestic film would be. So you see all kinds of, James Bond-type things and just a lot of people with British accents. But this was a really interesting story about King Henry VIII. Remember him? He had a wife, right? And he wanted to divorce this wife and marry his mistress. This was only he had six wives in the end, but this was only wife number one leading into number two. But to do this, he needed the Pope to grant him a divorce so that he could move on to number two. And there is this guy that was basically key to this. His name was Moore.
Thomas Moore.
Sir Thomas Moore.
Yes.
He was the Lord Chancellor of England, and he basically Henry VIII wanted him to sign a letter asking the Pope to annul the marriage, the marriage of Catherine of Aragon. And he didn't say that he was opposed to this. He basically said he's not going to take a stand. It reminded me a lot of what goes on in today's regime here, where people are noticeably quiet on certain things, but nobody really wants to, stick their neck out. This guy was just kind of looking out for himself and believing in what he thought was the proper role of everybody. He was not going to condemn Henry VIII, but he was also not going to endorse this. And for that, he slowly becomes an enemy of the regime. And again, it doesn't end too well for him, which is unusual because in the United States, films usually had to have happy endings. That was part of the code, and we're starting to see an end to that.
Things are a lot more racy and pushing the bounds a bit, and culturally it's there too, I think.
Yeah, but it's weird to see like another story of somebody full of self-interest that expects everybody to rally around him, and when they don't, he attacks them and makes their lives miserable. So you have a bunch of yes men following this guy around, and the few people that stand up for integrity, they pay a severe price for that. Sounds familiar?
So familiar.
Really, I don't want to see Trump in everything, but my God, it was really quite a story.
They're ageless. I mean, these are stories that repeat in history, I think, as well, in various ways, and it's sort of a subconscious thing that's going on in all ways.
Mm-hmm.
We have these stories that have occurred, and it's hard to not see the parallels, just of the state of being, the personality. It's incredible.
Yeah. Orson Welles was in this. He played a cardinal. You know, cardinals dress in red, just like the bird.
Mm-hmm.
Which came? Well, obviously the bird came first, right? I don't think the bird is imitating the religious guy, but still, it's kind of funny to see that he played a cardinal. I heard that Orson Welles was so full of himself that whenever he had a scene, he kicked the director out and directed himself. Yeah. I believe it.
He was a good cardinal.
Cardinal. He was a good actor, but
for
God's sake, be directed by a director.
He would have made a good Steve Bannon character.
He certainly would have. My goodness.
I think if Orson Welles played Bannon, it would be...
You know who else was in this playing a character called Cromwell was Leo McKern. You might remember Leo McKern as number two in The Prisoner from the late 60s.
Yes.
He played, in three episodes, he played number two. And he's fantastic. And there's a lot of really good acting in this.
It's vivid color, too, the really beautiful stark Technicolor and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
But it's an important period, I think, for religious tests, and it's mostly about power and how it's wielded and where you draw power from, and especially with leadership like monarchs and so on for nations to challenge the church in this way. It does show this kind of push and pull of power between the church and monarch and where each derives their power and how it exchanges in different forms. If the church had acquiesced to Henry VIII, then what more would he have been able to do to influence the church and thus take away from their power? Or vice versa, how does the church wield power over a sovereign king in that way?
There's a courtroom scene at the end that I think every lawyer should see, where basically Sir Thomas More is defending himself and playing some tricks on the prosecution, saying, no, I did not say that. I'm remaining silent. I'm not giving my reasons for remaining silent. And in so doing, I am not guilty of a particular crime. I'm simply not saying what you want me to say.
That's when it gets most interesting, in my opinion. I think it becomes this philosophical but also logical discussion of sort of the foundational stuff of language and law and how it manifests in society.
Yeah. All he had to do was just agree, just say yes. You know, you're the head of the Church of England, which is what King Henry VIII wanted to be, and, you know, everything will go away. All you have to do is do that. And how many times have we seen a story like this where all someone has to do, you know, like in 1984, admit your guilt, and everything will go away? Of course it won't, and of course, you know, you'll feel like you've compromised your values, and you'll wind up living a cursed life, in your view. It's a fascinating study. You might think a story about King Henry VIII is kind of dry and boring. It's not. It really is not. Another thing that I thought was interesting here were the constant trips back and forth from where King Henry VIII was
by boat to
Chelsea, where I think Thomas More was. And this would take, I think, like overnight or something. Basically, the king would send for you, and then you'd have to travel all night long and then go back to your house afterwards.
Well, you negotiate a price, and then the guy rows for you.
There's a guy rowing you the whole time, or a bunch of people rowing you the whole time. And it's just, I looked it up, and yeah, there is, in fact, a river that connects these two places, and it's about 20 miles apart. But boy, it would take a while.
At one point, he can't hail a rowboat because the rowers refuse, and they extinguish their torches as a sign that they are not in service.
It's like a taxi turning off his light. Basically, they have these torches at night, and they just dip them in the water, and that means we're not for hire right now. I don't know how he got back home, because he shows up back home, but he said he couldn't get a boat.
Yeah.
I don't know if he walked or what. Anyway, okay, so now we move on to the final film, the foreign film of 1966. Just saw this. It's a French film called A Man and a Woman. And, Kyle, I understand this was one of your favorites, was it not?
I have a couple things to say about this. I had no idea what was going on when we went into this. It was not good. I did not have a good experience getting into the story.
Mm-hmm.
It basically was putting me to sleep. That's not unheard of. We tend to watch stuff late but I had to check myself. I was like, no, it's not, I'm not too sleepy for this. It's sleepy. Like,
it's a sleepy film.
These extended dialogues. The thing had cars, like race cars in it, and I was bored. I wasn't interested.
You like race cars, too.
I like, and the vintage cars, those scenes I perked up a little bit.
A lot of driving in this film. A lot of driving.
A lot of cars.
Driving cars, race cars.
Commuting.
It's raining. Unbelievable. Okay, the premise, basically, it's a boarding school where both this guy and this woman have their kids there. The woman has a daughter, and the guy has a son, and you basically see people dropping their kids off. She misses her train back to Paris, and he's driving, and the headmaster of the school says, hey, can you give this woman a ride back to Paris? She missed her train, and that's how their relationship begins. But, you know, at the beginning of the film, though, you see this guy in his Ford, because Ford is everywhere in this film. He's driving around on the beach in his car with his kid. All these things that you can't do anymore. Driving, the kid is laughing his head off, and they're just driving circles by the ocean, by the water, on the sand. And at one point, they're on the street. This is basically, you just see the guy sitting as a passenger, directing his chauffeur to take him various places, and constantly changing his mind and being a real jerk about it. And then the camera pans over, and you see it's a little kid driving. And the guy is basically helping his kid drive a car on the street. You couldn't do that. You'd be in all the papers if you did that. You know, and everybody is smoking like chimneys. It's a different world.
Yeah.
But it is a boring world. I will give you that. It was a snooze fest. My God.
There was a lot of different elements that you wonder, is this an art film? What is the story? The dialogue is so just I felt passive. It was very just boring. Like, I just could not
engage. I didn't feel
engage.
Passive. I felt angry.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sleepy, quiet dialogue that you can't really get into. What is the action here? What is going on? I don't know. I just... It was a terrible bore.
Self-indulgent claptrap.
Yeah, and I did, but I don't think it was even as artistic as I was confusing it for.
Well, it's funny because a lot of people swear by this film and say it is artistic, it's brilliant, and it stands the test of time. What's particularly funny to me, though, are the people that are giving all this interpretation as to why some of it is in color and some of it is in black and white and all the artistic meanings behind that. And in actuality, it turns out it's in black and white because the guy ran out of money and couldn't film in color anymore. That's why.
No, that's a perfect example, and I think that's the one thing. Just when you think, I have it. This is a really, truly boring film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not artistic or cerebral. Then they change the film stock to, like, tinted photos and black and white. And you think, okay, whoa, it's jarring.
Yeah.
You think, well, maybe there is some sort of, playful design thing that you're just not quite on the plane yet to see in your mind's eye.
I was trying
in the
to
way
figure
the
out.
No, it's just this.
I was trying to figure out the theme.
Like,
okay, so it's going black and white when it's a flashback. No, that's not a flashback. That's really happening. Okay, so wait, when it's a character doing something sad. No, that's happy. So why is it black and white now? And yeah, it's because he ran out of money and made the best of it, I guess. There were some good parts. I like the scene where they're in a restaurant with their kids, and it's clearly unscripted because the kid is just acting like a kid, and that was kind of nice. But like all the scenes in this film, it went on for too long. At the beginning, you see a flashback to the woman's husband, who was a stuntman, and he's singing this song that just goes on forever and ever. And okay, I get the point. Every scene here could have been cut by half, and it still would have had the same effect.
Yeah,
one scene literally of a dog running on the beach.
Yes.
And he's not even the only dog. There's another dog that's a lot more interesting that they focus on. But then they go back and they focus on this dog running on the beach. It must have been like 5 minutes of just the dog running on the beach. Come on already.
No, I was like groaning for the last half hour. You had to, like, shut me up because I just couldn't stand it anymore.
Well, we have a no-groaning rule in the cinema, and that is important. No sleeping,
sorry.
No groaning, no throwing things at the screen.
It's my fault.
No, but what's really kind of interesting about all this, A Man and a Woman, filmed 1966 in France, they had a sequel 20 years later, A Man and a Woman 20 years later in 1986, and... they had another sequel after that called The Best Years of a Life. That was released last year. And get this, the actor and actress, both still alive, they're really old, though, and that's kind of what the film was about these really old people trying to remember just what the hell they did with their lives. And their kids were in it, too, the same actors that played the kids. They must be in their 50s now. So that makes it interesting, but it doesn't save the plot. I'm sorry. Man and a Woman, real snooze fest there. But that's going to do it for us. And we'll check out 1967, I guess, next. Films of the year that was. Okay, I'm glad we got that out of the way because, look, it's almost 22, and we spent a lot of time with the show. We usually try this 10 minutes before the show ends, and we would not have fit all that in. We have other things to talk about, but, you know, everybody else is talking about these things. Last week we were talking about going to war with Iran. Well, it seems like that might not be happening because of a series of events, which... well, it's fortunate that we're not immediately going to war, but the ignorance and the hatred is still there. Okay, so a lot happened since last week. We basically knew that Iran was going to retaliate against the assassination of their military leader. And, in fact, they did, right after the show, in fact. It's like they were listening, and they waited for us to get off the air, and then they started sending some missiles at U.S. military bases in Iraq. And, you know, you don't just do that. You don't just attack the U.S. and expect to get away with it. But you know what? They seemed like they did. Seemed like they attacked the U.S., said that's our revenge. U.S. wisely didn't say anything else, wasn't going to retaliate, apparently. And it all seemed like, okay, maybe this will work out. Until Iran made a fatal mistake and shot down an airliner. Now, we saw the bulletin of this last week when it happened. We saw that a plane crashed in Tehran right after takeoff, and we all knew right away that could not be a coincidence that just happened. And in fact, our worst fears were realized. Obviously, Iran was on edge after just having bombed U.S. bases in Iraq, and were expecting some kind of retaliation, which didn't come. And somebody in the military really screwed up and saw a plane and thought that was the retaliation and shot it down. It was a horrible, horrible mistake. What's particularly interesting, after an initial period of trying to cover this up, or at least some elements of the Iranian government trying to cover this up, they admitted it. They said, yeah, we made a mistake. We made a horrible mistake, an unforgivable mistake. And it was something that I thought was kind of unusual from that regime. And then what happened was the reaction against what they did from their own people was extremely strong and admirable. Yeah, you should condemn a government that shoots down a passenger plane. Absolutely. People were in the street. But the thing that I didn't see was any kind of responsibility towards Donald Trump for doing this in the first place, for creating a situation where this kind of thing was inevitable. No marches in the street, no admissions of guilt from that party saying that, yeah, we acted irresponsibly or we helped cause the situation. Nothing. Just complete, okay, it's all Iran's fault again. And then having the gall to say he was standing behind the Iranian people, the same people he won't allow to even come to this country, the same people he considers to be terrorists, and saying, yeah, we stand behind you as long as you're trying to overthrow that government. And, you know, if they do overthrow that government, it would be great if they did, but if they did overthrow that government, no doubt the United States would move in and try to build some kind of relationship with the new government. And here we go all over again with another Shah of Iran situation where we're pulling the strings and the people are losing in the end. So it really, you know, I'm glad there's no war going on, at least not right now. But I really wish people would focus on how this all got started and who else is to blame here. I see all these people condemning Iran, and yes, they should be condemned for shooting down the plane. But no condemnation of Trump setting up the situation in the first place. It's cowardice. You know, today the European nations are basically saying that Iran is not living up to the deal, the nuclear deal. And yeah, of course they're not living up to it because the U.S. broke that deal. No criticism of the U.S. for breaking the deal in the first place, but all the criticism is given to Iran for saying, okay, you know what, if they're not going to live up to the deal, why should we? How dare you break the deal, Iran? Nothing said to the United States. People have to stand up to us more. You know, we're acting like a bully. We need to be treated as such.
Yeah, I think it's not controversial to point out that this is how you have overreactions and stuff and so on after destabilizing politically or otherwise or diplomatically, whatever you want to point to. And so I think everyone should be able to admit it. But the most you're hearing about it, or let alone protest it, your own government doing something like that. The most you're hearing it is about criticizing Democrats from Republican leadership. That's where you would mostly encounter sort of the accusation that Trump has basically indirectly caused that plane to go down, which I would subscribe to. I fully believe that is the result of having destabilized. And this could be happening every day. We're actually sort of lucky that his actions aren't as consequential, that there are enough leaders outside of the fawning administration that we have to bolster sanity, I guess, against the sort of craziness that is coming from our own leadership.
But do they have any power, those people, those leaders? Do they have power to stop this?
Yeah, I think that's why we don't have as many overreactions in the face of pulling out of various things, NATO, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, those institutions still exist on a certain level, and they're able to sort of counter it and say, well, okay, you're going to act that way, that's fine, we still have an alliance, we still have interests mutually, and we'll work around this. And so to a great degree, I think that's how we've lasted, how we've been able to get this far along in this current administration. But anyway, I think if we responded in the way we ought to, we'd be in the streets every day. You know, and I, but that doesn't mean that having mechanisms with politicians or, you know, voting and so on and so forth aren't worthy actions. I mean, we can respond to it in various ways and actually more effective ways in protesting. But if we were as conscious as the Iranians seem to be about what their government has done and admitted to doing, we would be probably responding and very busy in the streets all the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the Iranian people have a good sense of democracy and fairness, and maybe more people are seeing that now than saw it before. It also lends itself to a theory that we've expressed here before, where basically, if you're not comfortable, if your life is not going great, or if you don't feel like you're getting all the consumer goods you deserve, you're a lot more likely to head out into the street and start demonstrating. And it's because, you know, we're all in our warm homes, driving the cars that we can't afford to pay for, and getting all kinds of latest consumer gizmos and smartphones. That's why we're not out there in the street. It doesn't really affect us. We don't want to really get out there and be noticed so much. Whereas in Iran, what have they got to lose? So, you know, I think, you know, as long as people are kept comfortable in one sense or another, it doesn't matter how bad things actually are. The perception is what matters. And that's why you're not seeing people in the street, because they don't see the point.
Well, yeah, I agree. I think you could also look at it as having all of your fortune to lose. We taking things for granted, in other words, I think is just as bad. But I think you could be reflective and not take things for granted, still be comfortable, but be effective in making sure that you don't lose that good fortune, and that others perhaps have an opportunity to be as fortunate.
Well, I just would like to see more consciousness on the part of Americans. You don't see that nearly enough. You see basically the same tired old people going out and showing up all the time, and then others just react against that because they see the same people all the time saying the same things. They're taken over by various groups that are not that popular in the first place. And we never seem to actually get anywhere. We never seem to actually be engaged in the democratic process. Whereas if you have a dictator, if you have oppression that's obvious, well, then there's motivation. There's motivation, and you get that spark. You know, we saw it in the 60s in the Vietnam era, where people actually were dying and being oppressed in various ways, the civil rights movement and all that. And it's happening today, obviously, but it's happening more subtly, and there's a lot more defense of the status quo.
I think the status quo is a good way to look at it. We are working in a system that is very, very, very broken right now. I mean, as far as getting legislation moving and effectively administering what legislation we have, we are dead in the water. We are basically stalled as far as having that institution work. And it's kind of distressing. And I think the message is more about really capturing it in small ways, getting just like the midterms in 2018. I think I've heard a lot of people referencing that in a hopeful way. It's good not to forget that those are those little wins along the way do a great deal toward jump-starting and getting things to where they need to be as far as functionality.
Agreed, yes. But the election coming up now is different because it's not based on the popular vote. It's based on the strategic vote. And if the same swing states are manipulated in the same way. Wisconsin just lost 200,000 registered voters that Democrats were trying to preserve because they didn't respond quickly enough to some kind of notice in the mail.
Right.
Setbacks like that could be fatal to changing the tide. And yes, when you have popular elections like, you know, House of Representatives, Senators, things like that, you'll see a difference. But when you have something like that is controlled by the Electoral College and a very bizarre and weird primary system where Iowa gets all this power, you won't necessarily see the will of the people reflected in the end result.
I think it's, it's important to just not blame ourselves. I think that's something I've been reminding myself. You know, we've been doing everything right as citizens, I think, and that's an important thing.
Have
to
you, Kyle? Have you done anything
wrong? I have.
Okay, you don't think this is on you at all?
I haven't been doing anything wrong.
Because I think a lot of this is your fault.
No, I don't think it is my fault.
All right, well.
I don't think it
that's
is.
That's what somebody would say if it was their fault.
Fine. Good for them. They can say whatever they want.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
We've done everything we can, I think. And I think a lot of citizens have. And they I think, have every right to demand a lot better of our representatives.
We're not going to beg for phone calls, but we are going to say that the phone lines are open for about 5 minutes or 7 minutes maybe. If you want to give us a call, 631-632-WUSB, 631-632-9872. We'd like to hear from people. You know, it doesn't matter what you stand for, what you believe in, what you say. Well, it does matter what you say. Be a little civil, I think. But we would like to hear from our listeners. We know they're out there. They always talk to us. But
tell us about your impeachment predictions. Tell us what you think about...
Even I'm tired of that. But, yeah, it's being sent to the Senate.
Yeah, it's happening.
And, I just hope that there is an actual trial where people get to question other people. I think, you know, if Mitch McConnell just votes on it and says, nope, that's it, people might react to that. They might say, wait a minute, what was that? That's not a fair trial. It doesn't matter how I feel, what I believe. We need to have the democratic process work out. You can't just have this guy decide we're not going to do it.
Tell us which witness you would like to hear from most.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear from John Bolton. I really would.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would.
Think about it. This guy says, I'll testify, sure, I'll be a witness. And then Trump steps up and says, you know what, I'm going to keep him from becoming a witness. I'm going to exert my executive privilege on him somehow and prevent him from saying what's on his mind. How does that not rub everybody the wrong way? How does that not demonstrate that, wow, there's really something to hide here? You know, one thing that impressed me over the last week was, so Iran finally admitted to what they did. It took them a few days, but they did it. They deserve some credit for stepping up and owning up to it. We never did that. In fact, you've seen all the people in the Trump administration stumbling over themselves trying to figure out which part of the lie to push. Was there an imminent threat, or as Trump says, an eminent threat? Yeah, he says eminent instead of imminent. He said it, and then he spelled it that way on a tweet. He doesn't know what the word imminent means, or he doesn't know how to spell it or something. It's insane. But you had everybody from Barr to Pompeo to Steven Mnuchin, who I can't even figure out why he's even showing his stupid face on these press conferences. What's he got to do with Iran? Basically saying, yeah, there was going to be an attack, but I don't know any specifics, but it was imminent, but it doesn't matter when, because that's not relevant. Basically, every day it's a different story. They're clearly lying. They just wanted to get this guy out of the way for their own reasons. And it's disgusting that they're not willing to be honest about it. Are we just going to let them get away with that? I mean, that's what they're doing. They are getting away with it.
Well, it's important not to let them get away with this. And I think we should just keep asking questions. I think reporters around the country and in the White House press pool, they have done a good job. They need to continue to do a good job asking questions, asking the right questions, getting mm-hmm. answers for people. These people that Mnuchin and Pompeo, they were basically standing in for the president in a press briefing that we haven't had very much of at all.
Right.
But consider that podium and that room is for the president to speak to us. So he doesn't he speaks at rallies. He speaks, you know, candidly. He has his little close-up, like 60 Minutes type interviews mm-hmm. on Sunday shows or with friendly, anchors or news shows. But speaking as a representative of the White House to the press pool directly is something he's completely incapable of doing. I think, really shows his incapacity that he can't even come out and speak and answer questions directly to in his own office.
They used to be White House press briefings every day, and now months go by between them. The president used to have press conferences where he answered actual questions and stood up for what he was doing. And it's so controlled now. It's so watered down. And, you know, it's sad to see this happening and for it to become normal.
But the more we ask, the worse they look, because they have nothing to say.
Well, we have to – there's a debate coming up tonight. There's only six Democratic candidates at this debate. That's the smallest yet. And I hope that they focus on the right things and not try to tear down each other and agree to back whoever it is that wins. I did see one interesting thing. By the way, 2 minutes left, 631-632-69, I'm sorry, wrong number, 631-632-WUSB, 631-632-9872. Again, no calls because people don't want to get involved. It's sad. Basically, it's an interesting thing that Bloomberg said. He's not on the debate tonight. But he's saying that, you know, it's not fair that Iowa gets to always be first. It doesn't represent our country. It's almost completely white and more conservative than a lot of the country is. Why is it that they always get to be first? You've seen so many people drop out before it even got to Iowa. And then after the Iowa vote in just a few weeks' time, more people will drop out before it ever gets to anybody in one of the swing states or even, God forbid, this state. Their vote doesn't mean anything. Their opinion doesn't mean anything. Why do we have this crazy system? I think it would make sense to have a system where each party decides, okay, we're going to do this state first because this is the one we want to focus on. We want to win this state over. We want to spend all our money campaigning here, and that would make a difference. Instead, we're locked into this system just like we're locked into so many other systems. So that's the one thing Bloomberg said that I actually agree with. You know, he'd be a better president than what we have now. I'm not really enthused by him at all. Don't want another billionaire. And I'm not enthused by Biden either. But you know what? Whoever wins, whoever is the nominee, is going to have my support. And I think we're fools if we think otherwise. Yeah, we need a progressive candidate. Probably not going to get a progressive candidate. But we can take steps in that direction by supporting whoever it is that does get the nomination.
Sanders Warren.
Yeah, I would love that. I would love that. But not if they're not going to win. If they're not strong enough, then we need to do the thing that gets somebody in power that will move us in that direction. We have to think the long game here.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Okay, so with all of those phone calls.
No phone calls, and that's it. We're closed now. We're out of time. Write to us. Tell us why you don't call. How about that? Can people do that? No one writes emails anymore either. It's sad what's happening to this country. You know, it's really sad. People just don't get involved. They don't want to make the effort. They just want their consumerism.
It's like the more speech and the more freedom and the more liberty you have, like two of those words are just made up words.
The less you want to do to possibly
the less you use it. Yeah, it's like you have something. Why do I need to use it? I already have that.
As people who come in here every week and do this, it feels good. It feels good to speak out and get your opinion out there. And if nobody else says anything, well, that's their loss. Again, otw@2600.com is our email address. We are out of time for tonight, but please keep paying attention. Watch the debate tonight. Watch the political process. Ask a lot of questions. Don't believe what you're spoon-fed by us, by anybody. And keep listening to WUSB, Stony Brook.
rain, we pray.